listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
To Dissident Island Radio, episode 228 is 15th of February 2019, and we've got another jam-packed show for you tonight. We've got part two of the Salamander DJ AfriVision set coming at you live.
Before that, we've got a piece from a comrade who participated in the long march that took place this week from Luxembourg to Strasbourg in support of the Kurdish struggle.
Got announcements, and Dr. G has rejoined us. You're going to be giving us some words about love and the meaning of romance and Valentine's Day, is that correct?
I'm back on the fucking ball with it. I've got some info to share.
Sweet.
Some learning for yearning.
Excellent. We're going to be hearing from Concrete Soldiers UK about their Inspire to Resist handbook that is going to be released at the end of the month. Andy is in the studio to give us the lowdown depressing news from the courts.
Evening all.
We're going to start off with words from the north, from Glasgow, about the Glasgow Autonomous Book Fair, which is happening on the 2nd of March.
I'm here talking to Mark from Glasgow Autonomous Book Fair. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Wonder if we could start by, if you could tell us a bit about this year's event, where it will be taking place and when.
Right, so it's, well, obviously it happens in Glasgow at a place called the Glasgow Autonomous Space, or GAS for short, which is in a warehouse about a mile south of the city centre in Glasgow. Book Fair is happening on Saturday the 2nd of March from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And we'll also have GAS's third birthday party on the evening, a benefit gig for GAS in the same night. If anybody wants to kind of find out how to get to us, there's pretty detailed information on the website, which you just Google Glasgow Autonomous Space and you should be able to find it.
So I believe you have a comrade there who's willing to tell us a bit about the venue, GAS, Glasgow Autonomous Space.
So GAS was started in March 2016, so we're coming up to our third birthday. Yeah, some people had been they'd been talking Glasgow for many years about trying to set up an autonomous space because there was no radical space for organising. Some people got their act together and signed a lease on a warehouse space, and then there was a meeting, an initial meeting, and then loads of people turned up and we chatted about what we wanted it to become, and it slowly grew into what it is now, which is like a multi-use space that gets used for political organizing and DIY craft and sharing of ideas and lots of eating food together and yeah.
Okay, great. Is this the first time Glasgow will hold a autonomous book fair? If not, could you tell us a bit about the previous ones?
Yeah, so as far as like using the word autonomous goes for a book fair, this is the first one, but there was an analogous book fair in Glasgow in 2011, which that kind of grew out of an occupation at Glasgow University, which was an occupation of a former PhD student's space at Glasgow University. And it was occupied for about 6 months, and that basically turned into this like alternative education centre. And a lot of people who were involved with occupation were anarchism. So it seemed like a good time to have a book fair. So we had one in December of 2011, and a lot of people who were involved with that occupation came to that. But that was pretty much like a one-off thing, because it was pretty much linked to that kind of one-off occupation. But I'd also like to mention the radical independent book fairs in Glasgow that have been going, that went on from about 2006 to 2016, which were run by a guy called Ewan Sutherland. So he would do like a kind of big book fair, like as an annual event, like a kind of large one, and then he would do individual pop-up ones at various events. at like the CCA or like this Human Rights Film Festival at the CCA once a year. And most of the books at that come from AK Press in Edinburgh.
And so what kind of groups would be represented this year? And for example, which kind of areas of activism?
So first of all, I just want to mention there will be like a number of anarchists and radical small press and zine publishers at the book fair. There will also be a stall from the local branch of the IWW Careers Network. There's a couple of vegan groups involved with the book fair. One that will do in a stall in the workshop, and one group's also doing the cooking. So we've also got Sisters in Cut involved, and they will be doing mostly based on women in prison, because I think they've told me figures of like 80 to 90% of women who end up in prison have been abused in some way. So they like have a campaign that basically, you know, victims of abuse shouldn't be like sent to prison. So another couple of groups we should mention are the Unity Centre in Glasgow, which does support work with refugees, asylum seekers and migrants, and a group called Ubuntu Women's Shelter, who are doing have created a shelter for female asylum seekers. They will be doing a workshop at the book fair called Decolonizing the New Borders Manifesto, which is something that's on the New Borders website. And basically, they consider that particular manifesto to be too Eurocentric. So it'll just be going into the details of that and trying to come up with a new manifesto for New Borders. And just also, we have strong links with these two groups, and they use our space like a lot over the year for benefit gigs or to hold meetings and things like that. Another group also linked to asylum seekers and refugees is a group called Herbal Unity, who provide free herbal healthcare to asylum seekers and refugees and migrants as well. And they came about 3 years ago because the law changed, making it more difficult for those people to access free healthcare. And they'll be doing that with the help of a group called Docs Not Cops. And I think there's a branch in London, but this is like the Glasgow one that's just recently set up.
And so is there still time for people to submit ideas for talks on the weekend, or how would people go about this if so?
We have completely run out of space for stalls, discussion talks and workshops, so no, people can't get in touch with us, although people still are. We've run out of space and time to do anything else.
Fair play. Moving on. Don't know if you guys had heard a bit about the events of the London Book Fair 2017, which ultimately has led to the sort of reformation of the London Book Fair across different venues rather than being centralised in one place. Wondered if you'd had put anything into place in reaction to this at all.
Yeah, okay. So the Book Fair in Glasgow is partly a response to the trans-exclusionary incident that happened at the Book Fair in London a couple of years ago, as you say, and also I've heard of other kind of turf incidents, as people call them, other book fairs. So we were taking all that on board, but it wasn't just the trans thing. We were kind of thinking in terms of how to make the book fair generally more diverse, because I know a few years ago there was an intervention at the book fair in London by a group of women, because the anarchist movement in Britain, or actually in the world, is pretty much dominated by men and still is. So that was another reason why we wanted to make the book fair in Glasgow as diverse as we could. The book fair we organised in 2011, there were attempts to make that more diverse, but some people accused us of being tokenistic, but then didn't do anything themselves to kind of make the book fair diverse. And although things like the gender balance of that particular book fair were good, it was basically mostly a turnout by white people. And certainly, given the links that GAS has, the groups and things like that, we wanted to kind of make it diverse in that way. Also, just on a kind of a more general point with GAS, we've called it an autonomous book fair rather than anarchist, because anarchist doesn't really describe all the different groups, doesn't reflect, you know, all the different groups that use GAS. So we feel it was better just to use the word autonomous.
And is there space available for people visiting Glasgow for the event?
There is. It'll mostly be people's flats, and the space will be probably quite limited, so we would want people to get in touch with us beforehand. So email us at glasgowautonomous@riseup.net, or you can go on the website and find our email address, or there's a Glasgow Autonomous Space Facebook page where people could message us. I would just say that people wouldn't be able to just turn up, because like, if anybody stayed here overnight, they would basically be locked in and that wouldn't be very safe. So we wouldn't do that. So we would ask people, anybody who's thinking of coming up, to get in touch with us first, and we should be able to find basic people's flats for them.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for that. That was brilliant. Maybe I'll see you soon.
Hope so. Yeah, nice one.
Okay.
Revolutionaries in the room, yeah. Keep puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel. We smoking plenty on my mom's, it keeps us steady. And in the morning we choose sativa, it's more heady. We keep a quarter of the sticky on the ready. The gear sort of loving dick a fucking steady. I'm being more than a greedy, cause then be healthy. To me it's more when the weed we cup, don't be medley. You can be sure that I've seen enough of the sensi. A connoisseur tell between us, gon' crush or hazy. The strength you show should just be a human right these days. For pain or for unjustly subhuman plight we face. We're aiming for bourgeoisie, subhuman prices fate. Sees maven up proofs, grabbing some cubic pounds from state. We pay revolution fees from huge bits found on rain. Can't wait for solution, we come to expropriate. Need pay for the troops when we come overthrow the state. Keen way to recoup world economy and blow trees.
We be revolutionaries in the room. Keep puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like perfume. We be revolutionaries in the room. We be puffing, guessing that shit is just like a fuel.
A track called Gas in the Bottle by Lil Guillotine, who's going to be providing all our tunes tonight. They're a US hip-hop artiste, so yeah, check that out. Now over to you, Andy.
Well, thank you very much. Here we are again with the activist court aid brigade, giving a little roundup of what's been happening in the courts in the last couple of weeks. So the big one has been the sentencing for the Stansted blocking rendition flight to Nigeria. And we're pleased to say that we've got as good a result as we could have hoped for in the circumstances. 12 of the people concerned have got community orders, what's now known as community payback, for 11 of them of 100 hours, and one for medical reasons, a 20-hour reporting duty in which you have to go and talk to the probation and say what an evil criminal you are. Three people who had recently completed suspended sentences for a occupation at Heathrow Airport have now got new suspended sentences of 9 months suspended for 18. So we hope that they do not get the temptation and itchy fingers to do something in the interim and be sent down for it. There are, however, interesting implications that have come out of this. One is, of course, as we have mentioned before, because of the recent judgment by the Court of Appeal, and in particular the Lord Chief Justice himself, Lord Chief Justice Burnett, in the Preston New Road fracking case, no one's actually gone straight to jail. Whereas it was looking very grim after the Preston case at Crown Court, where people got up to 16 months for sitting on a lorry. So this is a good thing and shows that the courts are following that judgment in that people are not being jailed for peaceful protest. Not that we're saying that everyone should be protesting peacefully, but if you choose to protest peacefully, then as we are saying all the time about the Extinction Rebellion people, if you can't do real crime, you can't get any time. So you pick and choose what you want to do. The funniest bit about the Stansted case, of course, is the fact that the Crown Prosecution Service has responded to all the very good publicity that we've got about this case by sending a long tweet whinging and moaning and throwing their toys out the pram that it wasn't a terrorist case at all. And this has actually been retweeted by Max Hill, who's the director of public prosecutions, who's head of the CPS, and a bit of a publicity merchant. He did that TV show last year on called The Trial, where he portrayed a barrister in a case. So, yeah. And they have been going around saying that they've done a really, really good job in prosecuting these people. And I'll just remind you that they spent 23 months from the point that they were actually did the action till the sentencing. And that's got to have a huge mental impact on anyone, not knowing what is going to happen to you, particularly if you have been just had a child in the last month and not knowing what you're going to be sentenced to. So we should not underestimate the mental health impacts on people of going through the court process. And so support and solidarity to all those people. We now have to admit that technically the Aviation and Maritime Security Act, under which the people at Chelmsford were prosecuted, is not a terrorism offence. But it just so happens that the government is bringing in more terrorism offences very shortly. And so I thought that this would be a good day to go through where we stand on the terrorism calendar, as you might call it, in light of the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Bill, which is the latest one, which we're expecting to be enacted this year. So, for younger viewers, way back in the 70s, in 1974, Prevention of Terrorism Temporary Provisions Act was brought in, 1974, reenacted in 76, and then again in 89. And this had to be reimposed by Parliament every year because no one had managed to fix the nightmare in Ireland. And when eventually there was a peace process in Ireland, the wonderful new Labour government of Tony Blair, remember him, kids, made an announcement that they were going to consolidate the terrorism legislation in the light of the Good Friday peace deal, and there will be one straightforward terrorism act. It got rid of a lot of the more onerous things, particularly the provision that you would be guilty of an offence if you knew about terrorism and failed to report it. What in English law is called misprision, that was abolished in 1967 because it was a rather ridiculous thing, and then brought in particularly to deal with terrorism in Ireland. And this was done in a nice consolidating act called the Terrorism Act of 2000. We campaigned against it, but we didn't get very far. Then came 9/11, and what happened after that was that they realised that they had misnamed the 2000 Act as the Terrorism Act, and it's encouraged terrorism instead of reducing it. And so an Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act was brought in to make it clear to people that they were actually against terrorism rather than for it. And this actually brought straight back in the offence of not disclosing terrorist activity if you knew about it. Since then, we've had, in 2005, a Prevention of Terrorism Act, which has since been repealed by the 2006 Terrorism Act. This obviously caused more terrorism. So in 2008, a Counter-Terrorism Act was brought in to deal with that problem. And then, obviously, they got a bit technical at this point. And so in 2011, we had a Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measures Act, which I can't even know what happened. But then, running out of different words, they brought in a Counter-Terrorism and Security Act in 2015. So all these acts are now, with the exception of the Counter-Terrorism Act of 2005, in force at the same time, making a huge mess that no one can understand. And just to top it off, the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Bill that is currently passing through Parliament is not bringing in new and different legislation. What it's doing is amending various of the offences and creating new and wider ones while increasing sentencing powers. So the particular ones that we've got coming in that are of particular interest is additions to Section 12 of the Terrorism Act 2000. People who express an opinion or belief that is supportive of a prescribed organisation, and there's a huge list of prescribed organisations, by the way, over 40, as I recall, of which include things like International Sikh Youth Federation. God knows what they've done. I've only ever seen them on the list. They haven't been around actually blowing anything up. Sentences are being increased in this. I had a sit down and tried to read through the 27 sections of this today so that I can inform you good people about all that's happening. And I'd said, well, just read it on legislation.gov if you've been made unemployed and get to sit home on benefits for the next 6 months and have got enough time to actually be bothered. What we have here is that things like gathering information about that might be useful for terrorism, the penalty has been increased from 5 years to 10 years. The aforementioned thing of withholding information about a terrorist activity has also gone up from, and this time from 10 to 15 years. And the offences under Section 1 and Section 2 of the 2006 Terrorism Act have gone up from 7 to 15 years. We're not quite sure how this is going to apply in practice, but it's not going to be great. Also, some of the things in it are utterly ridiculous. So there has always been a prescription on people wearing things that advertise or promote a terrorist organisation. What has been extended in the new bill is that items of clothing that might be in such a way or in such circumstances to arouse reasonable suspicion that the person is a supporter of the prescribed organisation can be seized and removed by a constable. Now, there is one good little bit of news on this one, is that in a special well down the list provision, they can't actually seize your underwear or anything that you're wearing directly over the underwear, so the underwear will be exposed. So if you're thinking about having your clothes seized for putting big bombs on it, put it on your knickers and you will be protected by the great provisions of the British law. I was also today going to give a quick shout out to other things in the pipeline, and as we don't have a huge amount of time, I'm going to plug the Canary, who has just published a online article about new provisions against travellers, because if there's nothing our government doesn't like as much, it's being racist to travellers. And they have, despite the fact that the actual National Police Chiefs Council didn't even recommend any new legislation was needed, our wonderful Home Secretary has proposed new changes to crack down on travellers and to particularly make, if they are trespassing on land, a criminal rather than a civil offence. And we're not quite sure how that's going to be framed in law yet, but alarm bells ring, because when the Canary actually asked the Home Office about this, they were told, oh yes, none of these provisions will be used against protesters. And if you haven't heard that lie before, you haven't been around the block as many times as we have. And so, to quickly conclude for tonight, our hearts go out to all the people arrested for burglary-related offences around Tide Mill Gardens over the last week, which is five, although four have now been dropped, but one person is actually being prosecuted for having items for use in burglary when obviously they were cracking a squat and they were held for 36 hours, and so much sympathy to them. And in our last statement, we will make a quick provision on the increased amount of tiger versus tiger violence in the country's zoos. We have noticed the two murders that have happened over the last year, and although we believe that tigers are entitled to legal support, we do call on our striped friends to curb this level of violence within their community and try to get on like all furry big cats should do. So with that, we will see you in a few weeks' time with more information on the law.
You like them, Artis? Their music? Of course you do.
Hey, everybody.
Do you make your own music?
Yeah, that's cool.
Is it copyleft?
Creative Commons.
Music?
Or spoken word poetry?
Yeah, really.
Get in touch.
Get in touch.
With
Dissident Island.
You can do it anytime. Get in touch.
Get in touch.
Email
us, motherfucker.
At
Dissident
Island
at
riseup.net.
I'm checking my emails. I'm checking my email. Oh, what's this? Oh, my goodness. Oh, no, thank you.
Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. If I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them. Ill if I kill them, hell if I kill them.
Philly kept the hammer swinging, witness kept the gym that he made.
What?
A boot Jamal to scoop from cellar, a hookah ball to root them all. Rally said and play medicine, 3% with guns, fascist plan. The crew would all take root and brought a duty, now subdue them all. Breathe the breath with wetsuit and listen up, this calls to action. A few get small, reputable, full spectacle with crew and all. Walking out to stop the camping by police on those with black skin. The students all stood up to tell the principals no cops in school.
If I get at him, hell if I can let him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I can let him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I can let him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I kill him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I kill him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I kill him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I kill him. Ill if I get at him, hell if I kill him. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. And if I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm. If I get it, I'm hell if I get it, I'm.
Hell if I get it, I'm. Hell if I get it, I'm. Hell if I get it, I'm.
So I am here with Nikita Wolf and Andy Worthington, who are the primary contributors to Concrete Soldier UK's Inspire to Resist handbook to resisting estate regeneration and social cleansing of our inner cities. How's it going?
Hi.
Yeah, good.
You're going to release this pamphlet on the 26th of February. And obviously we've had a lot of talk about housing regeneration and different aspects of housing and social housing. But why have you chosen this moment to release this handbook?
It's linked with our film Concrete Soldiers. I spent 3 years researching and filming Concrete Soldiers. And with that, I got a lot of knowledge. And I felt that the book was a natural step after having made the film to share the knowledge that we got and let people feel that there was options out there.
I think that's very important, isn't it? That although the scale of what we're seeing with the entire regeneration industry is huge, for people who are fighting for their homes, it's really important for them to have hope, for them to believe that something is possible and to draw on examples of successes and also on ways of resistance that may be helpful.
Who is this book for, though? Is this a book for people who've just discovered that their estate is going to be regenerated, or is it for just anybody living in social housing?
Well, it meant to be for anybody who is either undergoing or think they might be undergoing or about to be undergoing any kind of regeneration of their estate. Because we have found that the earlier you can come in and fight it, the more chance you have for being successful.
I would also say that it is of interest to anyone living in social housing in the broader sense of anyone who lives in social housing is potentially under threat. It feels to me like there's a kind of momentum to the growing resistance to what is not an isolated problem. You could live somewhere where they're threatening to knock down your home and build a new estate and making lavish promises which won't come true about how wonderful the new place is going to be. But it's not isolated. It's part of a much bigger political program across the capital and across the country. And so one of the things is trying to help people in their individual ability to resist, but it's also, I think, trying to bring people together in joining up people who are facing this, because if you look at the total number of people who are threatened, it's a vast number of people. The more we can get a kind of solidarity amongst people and an understanding that if you don't do something about it, that's not going to work. You have to fight. Then, you know, maybe that will be something really quite helpful.
Yeah. I think for me, it was really eye-opening. There were so many aspects of this whole regeneration. Because first you have the consultation, which is seemingly on the outside, it looks like it's really fair and they're trying to be consulting everyone. And actually, you know, when you really look behind it, they are completely manipulating the situation.
Yeah, totally.
There was quite a lot of times when I was like, wow, I really didn't realise this.
And in the time that you've been looking at housing struggles and struggles against estate regeneration, have you noticed people becoming a bit more savvy to these type of tricks and become a little more cynical?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think people learn, don't they? And the word spreads. So actually, from the Haygate, which is featured in the film and which is kind of the foundation story of modern regeneration, that has reverberated, and each time that there's a big regeneration program, more facts come to light, more truths emerge, more strategies, I suppose.
So you think people are quicker on the uptake, they're learning these lessons from other places, or do people have to start from square one every time they go through this process?
That's a good question. I think people are learning from each other. I think there's a lot more sharing going on, and that's what the handbook is definitely about. But, you know, people has contributed to the handbook who have got knowledge from other people. So, you know, we are certainly sharing information across borders.
And to your knowledge, is this the first book of its kind? Are there other people doing similar stuff?
There are other books out there. A lot of them are online. The whole point with this one was that it's very easily accessible. There are other books done which are much more dense and lots of facts, and which is great, you know, but I felt that it was really important to have something which is easily readable and just grabs people and gets the information across quickly.
So I guess in terms of who the book is for, then it's for people who are maybe a bit daunted by the whole process and don't want to be overwhelmed by things that they'll discover later but they're not quite ready for at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And just to give them a taste of what is out there. And then, you know, go out and do your own research and talk to people. And
so, I mean, all the places that we've mentioned so far this evening are London, or maybe even one part of London. But obviously this is going on across, well, the world and the UK more specifically. And you've had an opportunity with the film Concrete Soldiers to go out and tour around different places and meet a lot of people who would naturally be interested in fighting this sort of thing. So outside of London, is it the same picture that we have inside of London with this rapacious destruction of council estates for private gain?
Well, it's interesting because it's definitely at the moment more a big city issue. Smaller cities are affected differently. And I'd say they are the ones who get all the displaced people. And that's the biggest problem there. They haven't got enough housing then.
So these are people who've been displaced from more expensive places, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So, for instance, Hastings, I know, has got a lot of people suddenly coming to them and they cannot keep up rehousing all these people. So it's a big city problem, but I don't necessarily think that it's going to stay that way.
And in terms of people who, you know, their local housing stock has been filled by people who've been decanted from different housing estates, are they organising in any way around this issue? Because obviously it's created a huge local shortage then for them.
Yeah, so outside, I think people are more trying to get land and set up co-ops or set up new ways of building
community land trusts,
yeah, to build affordable housing. You know, there's a huge swathe of groups out there who is really trying to do something different.
It could be an amazing thing if we were able to do that. But at the moment, we're kind of trapped by council saying we don't have any money because we've been starved of cash by central government, which is completely true, but then also refusing to contemplate how they could address this problem in all kinds of creative manners, and just really taking this one route of, we don't have any money, but here are our friends in the private sector, or here are our friends in the housing association sector. These are the people with the money, and we're abdicating our responsibility to do anything. And it's trying to find ways that we could unlock the potential that people have all around the country for the things that we could do could be amazing if we were given the opportunities. And at a fraction of the cost of the huge profiteering that's involved in the regeneration industry.
And there is a whole section at the end of the handbook which details different options. So there's self-builders, co-ops, there's community land trusts. There's a lot of different alternatives explored, as well as means and ways to resist the regeneration schemes. So it's a useful resource for all concerned. Why do you think that councils are so wedded to this free market model, though? Is it just because there is this rotating door and they know they'll get a job with a property developer after they leave? Or is it because they lack imagination? Or, you know, are these alternatives that you're laying out completely pie in the sky and they're just not practical because, you know, people maybe don't have the wherewithal to manage their own communities?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wish there was a bit more hunger for alternative methods of fighting this housing crisis, but I think we are still, well, the councils are certainly stuck in their ways. I don't know if it's a revolving door necessarily. I think, I mean, maybe some people are very keen on that. But I think it's just a feeling of hopelessness within the whole council. And
yeah, I mean, they lack vision, don't they? So the obvious examples of corruption, we do see these repeated, where councillors do, funnily enough, go on to take on jobs with the very companies that they've helped. But when it comes to councillors and Labour councillors and their recognition that we live in times where a lot of people really do not have a lot of money, and that one of the great safety nets of the welfare state was to provide really affordable housing, they're abdicating their responsibility for it, and they're not showing any signs that intellectually they're interested in supporting these large numbers of poorer people who are their constituents. And then, so what goes with that a lot of the time is the whole gentrification aspect of the regeneration industry, as though that is a solution in any way, when it's not really. And a lot of those things that they're aiming for are, yet again, all they're going to do is make the problems worse. I live in Lewisham, and it's one of the things that's happening with Deptford. That's what a lot of these struggles are about, is these very fundamental issues about who you are supposed to be looking after and what people can genuinely afford. And I think they're just failing absolutely on that level of what people need, what people really need to be able to live.
And I think also we have to look at what it is that's happening in the bigger picture. You know, they are trying to dismantle the welfare state. We as the people, we have to either decide, well, is that a good thing, or do we want to keep the welfare state? If we want to keep it, we're going to have to stand up and be counted, you know?
Yeah, I'm not in any way advocating for the Labour Party or whatever, but you'd nod along happily if this was a Tory council and, yeah, they believed in dismantling the welfare state, but at some level, you know, in theory, somewhere the Labour Party are supposed to be advocates for the welfare state. And
but then I don't think the Labour that we have at the moment is proper Labour. I mean, I'm sorry, it's new Labour.
They're not representative of the people, and they're not representative of their own members largely either. You know, where I live in Lewisham, we have 54 councillors and they're all Labour. In the elections in May, Labour got 20% of the registered electorate to vote for them. 20%. The turnout across the borough was only a third of the registered electorate, and yet they've got all the seats. And then they claim to have a mandate. When they clearly have no mandate, the entire system isn't working. You know, and it creates these one-party state problems where they need dissent. They need to be challenged. They need to be thinking outside the box.
OK, so now we have councils elsewhere in London. So you take Haringey, for example, where they've had a huge amount of dissent, and it's all been pretty much centred on housing and the Haringey Development Vehicle and their cooperation with large private builders. You know, there's a new regime has been swept into power, and a couple of weeks ago they just announced that one of the major campaigns in Haringey against the redevelopment of what's known as the Latin Corner has been approved. So even if you have all this upsurge in energy and you supposedly elect people that believe in the welfare state or whatever you want to call it, you end up with the same result. So are we doomed? Is that a dead end in terms of affecting change in social housing?
I think it shifts the conversation a little bit in the sense that in Haringey, where there was this £2 billion project with Lendlease, it was on such a scale that it prompted this huge resistance. So now we've got a position where the party is clearly further to the left than it was, but is now confronted by the political realities of money and the lack of money. Probably what they're also doing is things that were in the pipeline are things that you don't want to disrupt. So I think it's going to be difficult for them in Haringey because there is resistance. And I don't think that that resistance is going to die out if a new bunch of people who've been elected start behaving in a manner that doesn't show that they've got any spine. But the fundamental problems here, I think, are about money and power and how we the people can change the way that things operate so that we're not constantly looking at enabling profit. We're looking at how things can be done for the people. And I think every time you look at that, you start wanting to cut out the profiteers. And I think that's really true of every aspect of life as we live it. I think this is a very heavily neoliberal country in which cuts are taken out of almost everything that we do all the time by people who are making profit without doing anything. And the whole system has become broken.
But outside of councils that have had this, the Haringey Spring or the Newham November or whatever you want to call it, have you noticed there being a critical mass, I guess, in terms of just popular distaste with this notion of estate regeneration? Have you noticed that changing the way that the powers that be behave towards these schemes, even if it's in terms of presentation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an awareness now from the council side that there is a dissident rising going on and that they do have to take note. Whether that is going to make a difference right now, I am not sure, because as Andy says, this has been happening for years and years, so it needs to go ahead. But I do think that the more people are campaigning and fighting it, it will in the long run make a difference. And that I truly do believe it's not going to be an immediate fix.
Something's changing, definitely. Being out on the streets of Deptford on a regular basis, talking to people, they know that new developments that are rising up, private ones, are for foreign investors, that quite often they're half empty, that they appear to have no entry level whatsoever for local people, and they're being lied to. And I think when we're talking about the replacement of council housing with new housing that purports to be social housing, then what's become quite interesting is that Sadiq Khan, who, you know, became the mayor of London and is Labour and is promising to address the housing crisis, he's introduced London affordable rent, as he calls it, which is in Lewisham, according to the council's own figures, is 63% higher than social rents, which is what people in council housing and housing associations pay, and that they're basically trying to set this as a new benchmark for the lowest level of rent, even though a lot of poorer people are already struggling to pay social rents. And people are latching onto this one quite quickly. And all around London, people are campaigning and telling the local people, this is what's happening. When, you know, you need to start focusing on what it means when they say affordable. So people are starting to demand that they want social rents, that they don't want to be hoodwinked in this way, that we can't be talked down to, that we can actually see through what's happening. Because the intention of this, coming from Sadiq Khan, was that everybody was going to agree that new homes would be built at London affordable rent. But what happened up in Haringey, because of the Haringey Spring, I kind of like that, is that Haringey Council has said, we're not building at London affordable rent, we're going to build at social rent. So if that's a precedent set in Haringey, that should spread across the capital to encourage more and more people to take on their own councils when it comes to rent levels. And that's, you know, it's a hugely important struggle, I think, that.
Yeah, and I think information is key. You know, if you know what you're asking for, you have much more power.
Yeah.
And that's really what a lot of what your book is about. So we've had, well, a long time of setbacks on social housing, and then we've also had a number of tragedies with Grenfell Tower being the most prominent. But I guess the silver lining is that people are increasingly aware and more assertive of their rights when it comes to housing, social or not. So you've had these years of experience and dipping in and out of different campaigns. Do you think that things are becoming more positive, or do you think that it's just an aberration and we're going to continue their slide into privatised housing and endemic homelessness?
Well, I think we are kind of on the edge between either. I think the campaigns are becoming more mainstream and people are becoming more aware. We do have to make a choice soon, though, about what do we want to see happening in the next 10 years, because it could easily slide the wrong way if we look away for a second. But I do think, I still feel hope. I still feel locally we can get together, and I think people are so powerful when they get together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Grenfell was a, you know, was such a massive thing because it didn't just show the disdain that people responsible for tenant safety have in general about social housing, but it showed that things are so bad that people can even die as a result of that lack of concern, lack of responsibility. This is what profiteering and cost-cutting does. In the end, people can lose their lives as a result of it. And I think that sent very powerful reverberations through society as a whole. And I hope that it carries on motivating people, because it's such a huge driver of things in North Kensington. When you, if people go on one of the silent walks, and I encourage people to if they haven't, they're on the 14th of every month, and they're incredibly moving. The power there of people's full realization of that, you know, we live as second class citizens in social housing, and that showed it so much.
So Inspire to Resist is out on the 26th of February. Where can people get it?
They can get it online, Concrete Soldiers website, which is concretesoldiers.co.uk. And there's a page there with the whole handbook, and you'll be available from there.
And on the 26th, come to the Rio Cinema in Dalston, because that's where we're launching it, at the screening of Concrete Soldiers UK with some other housing films.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you.
If you're looking for actions, campaigns, or events to get involved in, why not check out the following online resources? For London-based events, have a look at thefieldnx.com, maydayrooms.org, housemans.com, diyspaceforlondon.org, and commonhouse.org.uk. For UK events, check out these places: the Autonomous Centre of Edinburgh at autonomous.org.uk, BASE, formerly known as Kebele, in Bristol, at network23.org/KEBELE2, the Cowley Club in Brighton, that's cowleyclub.org.uk, the Oxford Action Resource Centre at theoarc.org.uk, Partisan, Manchester's cooperative arts and social space, at partisancollective.net, and the Sumac Centre in Nottingham. That's sumac.org.uk. And for events in the UK and the European continent, check out the Radar Events Aggregator at radar.squat.net.
Cool. So one actual announcement in the flesh. We've got the Lark Film Club returning to the London Action Resource Centre on Saturday, 2nd of March, with 6 days to go to the next women's strike. The event starts at 2:30 p.m. with footage of the 2017 and 2018 women's strikes from across the world, followed by three films about women going on strike in different countries at different times in the past century. Modesta, made in Puerto Rico in 1956, the 1976 documentary Union Maids, with three union activists telling their stories of organising in the 1930s America, and finally Red Skirts on Clydeside. This documentary, made in 1984 by the Sheffield Film Cooperative, focuses on the Glasgow rent strikes of 1915. The London Action Resource Centre is at 62 Fieldgate Street, E1 1ES. Doors open 2:30 p.m. The event goes on till about 7. There'll be time to mill about and chat between films, and refreshments will be provided. Vegan snacks are welcome if you feel, but you don't need to bring out and if you don't want to. And the Lark Film Club is a smoke/alcohol/drug-free event. Event is free and donations are appreciated. So now we are honoured to have with us in the studio, a rare occasion indeed, Professor G.
Oh, thank God those shitty announcements are over. That fucking never ended, didn't it? All right, I'm here to talk about love tonight. I'm going to talk about one of the loveliest days ever. I'm going to talk about Valentine's Day. To get us back to where I want to talk about, the Valentine's Day I want to talk about, we've got to go all the way back to 1919 in America and see the introduction of the Volstead Act. The Volstead Act becomes the 18th Amendment. This is the change to the American Constitution, which makes it illegal to move or purchase or sell alcohol. Not illegal to consume, but illegal to near enough do anything with it. It is quite interesting the reason the Volstead Act prohibition comes into America, the banning of alcohol. And it's got a lot to do with the women campaign groups at the time, like the Christian Temperance Union, the Anti-Saloon League. And it's quite interesting. Women at this point, it's a year before they get the vote, and it's a very, it's fucking full on patriarchy. It's the nasty fucking patriarchy, the classic kind of kind you get. And women aren't allowed to talk about aspects like being beaten up or being raped by their partners. That's not allowed, because if you say that in the dialogue of the time, the blokes in charge with all the votes and the power would just be like, yes, this is a good husband. But a space you can talk about that is with alcohol. And you can say, something's going wrong in my marriage and wrong in my Christian life, and it's to do with this poison alcohol. The system works. The system's fine. Patriarchy's okay. But alcohol's shifting it. So you get lots of women involved in the temperance movements trying to get rid of alcohol. There's been a shift with alcohol as well. Like, alcohol's something fucking beautiful that we, that all animals enjoy it a little bit. Wasps prefer fermented fruit. Goats fucking go out their way to consume it. Like, you know, distilling's also very important for clean water. In a time when you've got fucking cholera, when you're shitting in holes, like, you know, something that's been fermented doesn't necessarily have the same bad bacteria in it. But there's a change in 1920s America with the distilling process and the industrialization of alcohol production, which means you get whiskey on a far fucking cheaper level. So lots of blokes as well, they're moving, and they've got a bit more money. It's the boom in America. They're in the factories and the Ford plants. They've got a little bit more money in their pocket, and it's fucking easy to get a bit of whiskey. So you do get a rise in this nasty fucking violence. Prohibition comes in. And the thing that we see is what we always fucking see. Unrestrained capitalism enters the fucking fold in the form of gangsterism. In New York, there's 15,000 bars in 1919. There's fucking 35,000 in 1924. We get the birth of the speakeasy, and speakeasies are fucking cool as shit. Like, they're cool as shit for a number of reasons. Secret fucking access inside to them. Like, you know, the booze you're drinking inside is moonshine. Moonshine is fucking marvellous. The reason it's called moonshine is because you've got hillbillies with distills out in the fucking mountains of God knows where, and they make it under the moonlight. How beautiful is that? That's fucking artisan. You'd pay a fortune for that in Shoreditch today. Like, bathtub gin. It might send you blind, but, you know, it does the job. Alcohol becomes a little bit sexier as well. Like, if you're off to a speakeasy, one, you might hear like a black musician. Oh, it's tantalizing for the time. But also, who's that clean looking Italian guy in a nice suit on the other side? Is that a gangster? Oh, romantic. These are the people that are in Time magazine on the front page. One of the big people you get emerging out of this scene is Al Capone. A little bit of everyone's touch of an anti-hero. Like, you know, Al Capone's fucking sexy. Like, Al Capone is the kind of classic gangster figure. And their lines to the press, they lap it up. Like, you know, I'm just a businessman. I'm just supplying demand. You can get more with a gun than a kind word alone. All kinds of levels of shit. Like, you know, Al Capone's very cool because they've got a cigarette. And, you know, the Al Capone makes out from the very start that they're a Robin Hood figure. They whack money towards the poorer communities. They reinvest in the community. But it's darker. Al Capone's obviously also involved in running brothels, in racketeering, threatening people. And Al Capone, by 1923, is pulling in over, in today's money, at the time we're talking about $1 million a year, but in today's money, close to about like $250 million a year. That's a vast amount of money to be going off to gangsters. $250 million to the people in racketeering. What do they do with this money? Well, Capone, by his influence in the police force, the judiciary, senators, reporters, you want to fucking report? All right. Drinking booze is fucking fine. But just because you're in a pub, you don't want to fucking necessarily a mass murderer sat next to you. But you fucking talk about this, you're going to end up murdered. Like, who are you going to go to? The police. Well, the police are running their own speakeasies for themselves, but also they're being paid off by the gangsters. This comes to light really for the American people on St. Valentine's Day, 1929. Al Capone organises for the rival mob, I think it's the Irish. You know, some people get well into gangster facts, I don't really particularly. Like, Al Capone, like, he organises the wiping out of the rival gang, which I believe is the South Side, which is the Irish. two people in police uniforms march into their local headquarters and they use Tommy guns. Tommy guns are fantastic as well. Tommy guns come out, the Americans, they develop them for the First World War. You would have had a fucking thousands of Yank soldiers going around with submachine guns on the Somme. But no, you know, the war ends, so the Tommy guns, they obviously just sell them all off to the gangsters instead. Like, genius idea. Two police officers step into the garage, they line up the rival gang, machine gun them all to death. Like, a couple of our gangsters come in, Tommy guns behind them, bang, 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 and they fucking load them full of bullets. They really fucking go to town. One of the guys actually survives, and the police get him to the hospital, and he's there in the hospital, he's just about stabilising. 14 bullets in him, 14 bullets, and the police say, "Who shot you?" And his response is, "Nobody shot me." Well, like, even to the end, what bullets, officer? No, I don't see anything here. This massacring of, you know, gangsters, there's an engineer in it as well. It's a real fucking shock to America, especially the idea. And to this day, they say, gangsters in police uniform. It's fucking coppers. They'd bought off the police. To this day, this was the shock point for America, that breaking the law, the police, fucking hell. Who do you go to if you got a hoodlum on your street who's a gangster with a Tommy gun? What, you go to the police? Fuck off. The jury. So everyone's fucking bought into it. The whole system's corrupt. It still stays in place for quite a few years, though. It's not until 32 where America finally gets rid of prohibition. But by then, the gangsters are already in charge. Unadulterated black market exists in its purest form. I'm a fucking libertarian. Like, you know, a good communist, anarcho-syndicalist madness is the way to take care of it. But until we get to that point, surely the St. Valentine's Day massacre is only one good message, and that is decriminalise it. Everyone should be allowed to get high. Smoke lots of weed, because Valentine's Day needs it. And that's my history. It was a bit of a ramble today, wasn't it? It kind of went along. You're going to cut me off mid-sentence.
No, mate, I'm not cutting you off.
Oh, I see. I've got more ramble in me.
Go.
No, I'm out.
Thank you very much, Professor G.
Hi, kids. We hope you'll play along and have fun with this
radio show.
However, please play safely. Before
listening,
ask your parents to help move
the smoldering wreckage
of capitalism
and other objects you might bump into. And please remember, don't run, jump, or dance while playing
Dissident Island
Radio.
Thanks.
Now, in our final piece on the show tonight, we discuss the ongoing Kurdish struggle and the campaign to free Abdullah Öcalan.
Hi, Kawa. Thank you for joining us here on the show. Do you want to introduce yourself a bit?
Yes, well, I can say that I'm right now in a bus in a direction to Strasbourg for joining the demonstration that will happen tomorrow in solidarity with the Kurdish movement, and that I'm taking part of the International Long March, and several people from more than 10 countries from different places around Europe are me right now in this bus going together to Strasbourg.
Cool. And the march started in Luxembourg. There was a kickoff event in Luxembourg last Sunday.
Right, exactly. We started in Luxembourg and we have been walking since there. And we have been crossing different villages and different places around France and meeting the different Kurdish community and different political groups in the sense that we have been crossing.
How many people are on the march? How many people are doing the full kind of distance?
Yeah, in this march from Luxembourg to Strasbourg, we start like around maybe 60, 70 people, but now we are much more because there was also, like, there's several marches. There was one that started in Germany, but German police stopped them and like attacked them and forbid them to continue the demonstration, like after 2 days that they were working. So they decide to stop their march in Germany, come and join the international march. So now we have this, like, the international march with around 60, 70 people, with also this other Kurd youth march that they are also, like, I think even a little bit more, like 80 people that are together. There is also another march that is coming from Switzerland. There is also, like, a lot of people that will come to buses for demonstration for tomorrow in Strasbourg.
And what's been the response from local people on the route of the march? What response have you received?
Well, especially the Kurdish people is welcoming us, like really happy, really motivated to see so many people in solidarity with the Kurdish people and with the Kurdish struggle, because we are also demanding the freedom for Vlojo Jalan, because in fact today, 15th of February, it's 20 years since he was arrested and put it in jail, in isolation, and that's why we are asking also for the freedom of Vlojo Jalan.
So part of the demand of the march is petitioning the EU to put pressure on Turkey to release Öcalan.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the points, and somehow that's why we are also going to Strasbourg, where the European Council is there, and also the building of the CPT, the Committee for Prevention of Torture, because this is in complete isolation. They are not allowing him to the lawyers, and there are several questions about how is his health situation. The Committee for the Prevention of Torture make a short visit 1 year ago, something like this, and they just release a note saying that he was alive and that he was okay. They never said anything if he's under torture or not, and we don't know anything about his health situation, and we are asking that at least his lawyers can see him, because he's in complete isolation for now, today, 20 years.
And what is the European Union's position on that? Because in the mainstream news, we hear a lot about the US and Turkey and Russia and Iran and the roles that they are playing in what's going on in Syria at the moment. But there's a lot less information about the EU's position and what you just said about how the German police stopped the German part of the march from marching altogether. That's not really a good sign.
No, it's not really a good sign, and we can see how somehow for the European Union we can see how they still fighting completely with Turkey, because somehow like Turkey is a NATO country, and Europe and the NATO and US, of course, and all the countries of NATO keep Turkey close to them, because it's like being able to do the things that the Western countries cannot do. Middle East, Europe is like that Europe cannot do. Turkey is there, and being a member of NATO, it is an alliance with the Western powers in Middle East. But we can see how in the last years, especially in the year, Turkey is turning more close to Russia and to Iran. And Europe is trying to also keep Turkey together. We have also the deal for the refugees when Turkey received at the beginning 3,000 millions of euros in material of supporting refugees, but at the end there is not any track of this money, and we can see how this money it's ending in building military bases, or like the wall that Turkey built in 2016, a wall that it's more than 600 kilometers between the border of Turkey and Syria for control the Kurdish people to not cross from Turkey to Syria. And we can see how in Europe the ban on PKK, it's only forcing a lot of Kurdish people to have more difficulties to work in solidarity, since we can see how Abdullah Öcalan had been the president of the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, and this ban accusing the PKK of terrorist organization, it's making the things much more difficult. But at the same time, in fact, a few months ago, there was an initiative in the European Parliament to remove the ban on PKK. And at the end, the last sentence on the European Parliament, they were saying that, yes, it's true that PKK never make any kind of terrorist attack or any kind of terrorist action in Europe. So it's right that maybe we have no reasons for keep them on the terrorist list. But anyway, even saying that, the PKK is still in the terrorist list of the European Union.
I mean, the whole situation is very confusing for somebody from the outside to fully understand, because the PKK is not actually in Syria or in Turkey, but Öcalan is arrested in Turkey, and the US were supporting the YPG, YPJ, the Syrian Defense Forces, to defeat ISIL in Syria. And they recently announced, just less than 2 months ago, that they were eventually going to remove their backing and withdraw from Syria. And this has caused quite a lot of concern about what Turkey is now going to do in that northwestern region of Rojava. So do you want to say a bit about what people's response there has been?
Yeah, it's true that can be a bit complicated, because we have a lot of different actors in the same conflict. First, for clarify the situation, it's important to understand that when we talk about Kurdistan and about the Kurdish people, we are talking about a lot of times about Turkey, but at the same time about Syria, about Iran, about Iraq, And also, of course, like more than 1 million of Kurdish people that are in Germany and in other countries all around the world. It's a lot of actors at the same time. So when we see the situation in Rojava right now, we can see since 2002, there is this social revolution that is happening there, where the Kurdish people in the north of Syria start to manage society outside the frame of national state. So it's interesting to see how the Kurdish liberation movement was born with a frame of national liberation movement in the frame of building a Kurdish state. But at the beginning of 2000s, they reformulate their political project and they make this step that they call democratic conflict, pushing for a society that is based on values of the human liberation, social ecology, and direct democracy without state. So we can see how since the autonomy in Rojava in 2012, they are building this society based in these ideas. We can see how in Turkey, the Kurdish people in the southeast of Turkey, they were also building this autonomy, this system based on democratic conference, but the Turkish state completely attacked them. And in 2015, they start a lot of military operations, destroying cities like Dusaybin were completely destroyed by the Turkish army. It's important to see that now the army wants to enter the north of Syria, but it's not something new. Like the war from the Turkish state against the Kurdish people, it has been for a lot of years. In the 90s, there was a huge war. Now Turkey wants to attack the Kurds in Syria. But of course, Syria means to cross a border. So it means that still Turkey is a country that is part of NATO. And of course, like Russia, that it's a country that has been supporting more the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, can put objections if Turkey wants to enter Syria. So that's why also there are so many negotiations and diplomatic interactions with so many different actors. And Turkey is getting closer and closer to Russia in order to have green light from Russia to allow them to attack the Kurds in northern Syria, in Rojava. So we can see how since the announcement of Donald Trump in December 15, that they withdraw from Syria, they start to withdraw the diplomatic body of US in Syria. Some soldiers are still remaining there. And this has been presented for Erdogan as an example of like how Donald Trump is ready to withdraw from Syria for allowing Turkey to enter there. After that, there were some contradiction messages. It's not clear if US will allow Turkey to fully enter the north of Syria with bombs and airplanes and drones like they did in Afrin 1 year ago, or if they will to stop Turkey to use planes. So with the discussions ongoing, you can see how Turkey is now also talking with Iran and Russia in this international meeting that they are having after the process of Astana. And it's a really complicated situation with a lot of different actors that it's sometimes difficult to follow, maybe.
And how does it feel to be a part of that, actually? Because it's one thing to attempt to build an alternative kind of community structure that's really quite large. The region that it's covering is not insignificant. There's many, many small communes that make up this region of Rojava in northeastern Syria. So how does it feel to be a part of that and be trying to build that and at the same time just be so incredibly vulnerable to all of these international geopolitical movements over which you have absolutely no influence, no control, no ability to... You're just completely vulnerable in that situation.
Yeah, and this vulnerability is a really interesting point, no? Because we can see the hegemony of the model of the nation state succeed on taking all the world. And since the Kurdish movement in northeast Syria, they are developing a society outside the frame of national states, the threat of national states is always there. And we can see especially how Daesh, like the ISIS, the Islamic State, start to try to create their own system also outside the frame and in opposition of that. And of course, the Kurdish people were in the need to defend themselves. And that's what allowed them to also take so much territory, because the threat of the Islamic State and the terror society that they were implementing on all the, to all the people was a direct war. And somehow the Kurds were saying, like, we are defending ourselves and we are fighting also, but not fighting Daesh just because we want to fight them. It's just because this is a threat for humanity. This is a pure fascist system, so it's an anti-fascist struggle, and we need to defeat them. And since all this war against the Islamic State, a lot of different territories that have been liberated from the caliphate had been joining to the autonomous administration that the Kurds started in the north. When I went to Rojava and I had the opportunity to live for 1 year, how this society is working, interesting to see how they are succeeding on developing a system outside the frame of the national state, and with the woman liberation as the main point of this social transformation. But of course, all the states that are surrounding this territory don't recognize Rojava as something that they can interfere. So there is a problem that when the situation of war came, it's really difficult to be able to defend yourself from an army like Turkey, that it's a member of NATO with warplanes, with drones, like full technology of NATO. And of course, no one will ever sell or give anti-aircraft weapons to Rojava, because they are not an actor that can recognize as a state, and they don't want to be. So somehow it's a really complicated situation, and we can see how all this structure of capitalism and the connection of capitalism with the weapon industry, it's creating a system that it's not allowing other projects outside the frame of national state to exist, because there is this military frontier that you cannot go. And we saw it in Afrin 1 year ago, when was the invasion of Afrin. It was really clear how technology, like military technology, it's making a border that you cannot overpass.
And I think something that Rojava has shown us over the past years is just how difficult the creation of an alternative way of structuring society really is. I mean, we had some of this experience with seeing what was going on in Latin America some years ago, but I guess Rojava was the most recent example of this. And it's been really impressive to see people actually putting their own lives on the line and going out and fighting the powers that are trying to stop them from existing. Has that willingness to fight and the demands that that fighting has made on that society, like, has it had an impact on the communes and the way that they're organized, or has it had any effect in that way?
Of course it has effect, but I think it's important to understand that the Kurdish people, like, they are used to live outside the frame of national state. We can see how a lot of the structure and the system of communes that they are developing, it may sound like something new for us, but for them it's nothing that it's completely new. They have been living in this system like from forever. So it's important to see that this process that they are doing, it's without state, because they have the knowledge of how to state. And it's important to see how at some point the communes are able to exist now, because Daesh has been defeated. So a lot of places before, the communes was the war, and the war was the thing that was more necessary. So we can see how not only the Kurdish people from Rojava, but the Kurdish people from all around Kurdistan came to the northern Syria to fight against the Islamic State, because they know that the Kurds are their brothers and their sisters. And every step and every city that was liberated, the Kurdish people was able to go back to their cities, and then they realized that they were able to win the war, so they were able to bring this system of democratic conflicts to the maximum example. So before, they were already somehow living in a communal way, building up communes, but the point is that now the Syrian state left because they were not able to fight the Islamic State, and now they are self-managing all the parts of the society. They succeed on creating a self-managed system of justice, a self-managed system of economy based on cooperative self-managed system. So they are in a full way of managing all the aspects of life, all the aspects of society outside the frame of national state. And of course, for the communes, it have a huge impact, this war, as they know that they can exist and they have the life that they can have today because the war that they did. And they always remember all the people that has been fighting and all the people that has died.
And what is it like to be an international there? What does it feel like to go there as an international person?
Well, it's a really interesting experience. We can see how a lot of people already went there as internationalists, especially since 2014-15. A lot of people start to join more in the military side, in the fight against the Islamic State. But since the war against the Islamic State was able to take more land and to liberate more territories, the society system that they are building is attracting more and more the attention of internationals. So I was one of these internationals that went there in the civilian side, I was traveling there for see the society, for see what means to build a revolution, what means to build a society without a state, what means to build this system of democratic conferences that they are building. And for me, I can say that I was really impressed for see a lot of things that seems impossible to be. But at the same time, it's a really hard situation. So they are just fighting a war that means a lot of people and a lot of resources needs to focus on this war. And it's really important to see how the situation there, it's really hard. But what they are building, it's something that can bring a lot of inspiration in order to develop new ways of thinking and understanding the society that can allow humanity to think beyond the nation state, beyond capitalism, beyond patriarchy, and try to bring new ideas and new hopes to the revolutionary movements in all around the world. Like we saw in the 90s with the Zapatistas movement that was giving inspiration to a lot of movements, a lot of revolutionary organizations. We can see how this is happening in Rojava, and to be able to be there and to see not only the nice parts and all the beautiful things that you can see, but also the difficulties, the sacrifices and all the problems that they are facing, it's giving perspective for how we can also start to develop a revolutionary movements all around the world in our countries. Because somehow if we go there as internationalists, it's not just for going there for see the situation in Rojava. We are also going there for learn, for understand their movement, how they succeed on doing this revolution and then bring these ideas back home and being able to develop an internationalist movement that can develop a revolution all around the world. So for me also, I'm from Catalonia, so the impact of the international brigades that came in Spain in 1936, all these more than 50,000 people from different countries fighting fascism together, it have a huge impact. So now we can see how fascism is attacking Rojava, is attacking the people in northern Syria. So it's important also to have this in mind and to see that internationalism is something that is not only in the books of history, it's something that it's happening right now. So we can see internationalists from all around the world also going there to learn, to support, and even to fight for defending this revolution.
You said that the march that you're doing right now is calling for the EU to put pressure on Turkey to release Öcalan. So I have a slightly perhaps controversial question. How important is Öcalan to the movement? Mm-hmm. Is it necessary that there is a leader in the movement, or is it more of a kind of solidarity support for an arrested comrade? Or like, what's the dynamic there?
Yeah, it's a good question, and especially for anarchist people who have been interested in the stateless society that they are building, it's sometimes a bit contradictory, you know, this focus on the leader. But it's important to understand how when Abdullah Öcalan started this movement, he was always like trying to give perspectives at developing a revolutionary line in this movement. And of course, he has been respected for all the perspective and all the ideological background. He's a person that was writing a lot of books and was giving a lot of political perspectives because he had been studying a lot, different revolutions, different movements. And the point is that he did not eat alone. So he was always pushing for education, for studying, for learning together. So the threat of like catching him and putting him in jail when Turkey was making the trial, they condemned him to 7 death penalties. But somehow Europe and the Western powers was putting pressure for make the Turkey cannot execute him. And they have been keeping him in complete isolation in this jail. So it's important to see also how since he's in jail and he's not able to push for the revolutionary struggle in a practical way, he had been using this time to read a lot and to develop this frame of democratic conference. So it's important to see Öcalan not only as the political or military leader, but also as the one that brings the ideological perspective. All the ideas of democratic conference that are summarized in this Manifesto for a Democratic Civilization, that it's these 5 books that he wrote from prison, are the books that are presenting this model of democratic conference. That somehow we can see that is a synthesis of all the things that he was reading and all the things also that he was experiencing when he was in the guerrilla movement, in these revolutionary movements. So when we read these ideas of democratic conference, we can see influence from all this Marxist background that this movement have. But of course, we can see also a lot of influences for different authors. So he's even quoting Bakunin in some books, Silvia Federici. So a lot of different thinkers that are giving perspective. So he's the one who made the synthesis. And for this, the Kurdish people, it's really know that how he put a lot of effort on giving a perspective for a solution, not only for Kurdistan, but for Middle East and for all the world, making the synthesis of all the revolutionary movements. And for this, it's also important to understand the reality in Middle East. Like, Middle East has been a place where the oppression and all the attacks of the colonialism has been really strong. And we can see how 100 years ago, after the First World War, the Western powers went there and started to build the nation states. And the dynamics on Middle East are not fitting with this system of nation state. And they are keeping with the system of tribes and different clans. So for them, this point of the leadership is something that is really rooted in the society. That, of course, from a Western view, can be difficult to understand and to give meaning. And I think that even for me, before to go there, it was sometimes difficult to understand. But there you can see how this kind of leadership is bringing unity in order to face the enemy. So somehow, also the point of that he's in isolation as a political prisoner, it's also increasing the solidarity for all the people. But it's not only him, like there are thousands of Kurdish peoples in jails, especially in Turkey, that they are also developing a huge movement of resistance in jails and an anti-jail movement. But of course, like he, as the leader of this revolutionary movement, have a special importance for the Kurdish people.
So there was a very interesting and really quite brutal critique a few years ago released by AFED, the Anarchist Federation, of Öcalan, and comparing him to Gaddafi and Gaddafi's kind of pre-dictatorship politics and then what actually transpired. And I wonder if recognising the kind of the brutality of the geopolitical dynamics that are going on with all of these nation states fighting for different reasons over this territory, and then also within the wider region of Kurdistan, how many different smaller groups exist that are also not all towing exactly the same line, which is positive in some way, and also then the ability of a leader to unite these people. Having been there, do you feel that there is structural resilience within what you've seen within the structure of the communes against a kind of rehash of the Gaddafi situation, of kind of the leader coming in and then eventually capitulating beneath these geopolitical dynamics and having to force a dictatorship through? Like, is there a resilience to that ever happening?
Yes, for sure. The implementation of democratic conflictism, it's really interesting to see how they are pushing a lot for the development of the communes, how they are really creating systems for avoid any kind of centralization of powers. Like, for example, they are building different committees for take care of different things. And for example, in Rojava, there is one big city that is Kamishlo, somehow the biggest city in Rojava. And they are putting a lot of effort for force these committees, like for the culture or for economy, and to avoid to put the central place of these kind of institutions in Kamishlo and to decentralize completely them. Somehow they have a huge analysis on the society and the nation state. And what they are understanding is that nation state, it's the main power of centralization, homogenization of control. So in order to avoid dictatorship, in order to avoid fascism to happen, the most important thing is to decentralize the power, to decentralize the society, for allow anyone to be autonomous. And in the commune system, it's exactly this. They are trying to give power to every commune that they can solve their problems. But they understand that the situation it's complicated, so that somehow it's important that still keeping some structures and some institutions where these communes can go if they have faced problems. So the idea is that the commune is able to solve all their problems and all their needs in the life, but in case that they are facing problems that they cannot, they make coordinations in a district level, in a province level, in order to being able to support all these communes. So we can see how it's a system of power that is built bottom up. And it's important to see that this some kind of central institutions have this mentality of like serving the people, not like the Zapatistas were saying, like place where the people rules and the governor obeys. So they are creating central institutions because of the needs of some dealing with some things, especially with the military situation, with the war. But they are trying to reinforce these experiences of direct democracy the communes are giving to the people. But of course, You cannot change from one system to another in one night. It needs time. It needs that the people needs what means direct democracy, what means to manage their own life in all the levels. So for this, they are seeing the history also as a process. So they want to push for this less society, for this direct democracy. But they know that managing a society of like 4 million people, 5 million people that are living now in Russia, it's not something easy. So they are trying to develop different institutions that ensure that this revolution is able to defend itself, because this is one of the main points of this movement, self-defense. They understand how all the living beings need to be able to defend themselves in order to survive. So they are trying to push also for all the communities, all the things to have their own self-defense system. And I think that this is the main like structure that you can have in order to avoid fascism. When you have a centralization of power that to control the others, if you decentralize the ability of self-defense, this cannot happen, because any kind of commune can see that, hey, this is not going in the line that we want to live as a society. So we cannot allow these to control other things. So this point of like develop self-defense in any commune, it's I think one of the best ways to ensure that dictatorship will not be ever possible there.
Thank you very much, Kawa, for taking the time to discuss with us these crazy complexities of an actual real world attempt to live without a state. So if people want to support the march or the demonstration or moving forward to support the struggle in general, how can they get in touch? Where should they go? What are the points of contact and information?
Yes, right. It's tomorrow, Saturday, and it will start in the morning with a demonstration. And then we will have a festival with Kurdish music and a gathering for the Kurdish community and international, the world, that want to support this revolution and these people. There is a website, freedomforjalan.longmarch.com.
Cool. Thank you very much. I hope it's successful.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you a lot for this time, and I'm happy to talk with you.
Awesome. So we've got now the part two of Salamander DJ's Afri Vision set, which was recorded by Chickpea the other week. And part three is coming up on the next show. So, yeah, thanks for listening and enjoy.